Stones? No, The Simpsons. Flimpsons? I gave up. Yes, I write for the Flimpsons. I never hear of it. While almost every country loved our show, the French hated it. Why? Because the French suck. Seriously, our first season, we did an episode where Bart went to France, and the French pulled our show off the air for 17 years. The show has since returned, and the French now love it. This experience taught me something key about The Simpsons. Americans look at Homer Simpson and go, "That's my dad," while foreigners look at Homer Simpson and go, "That's an American." In fact, the nation of Venezuela canceled their run of the show because, quote, "it promotes bad American values." So they pulled us off the air, and they replaced us with Baywatch. Editor's note, did this really? Me, yes, damn it. Nations who love the show suddenly don't find it funny when the Simpsons family visits their country. Famously, after the Simpsons went to Rio, the city's tourism board threatened to sue us. Their complaint read something like this. When the Simpsons came to Rio, they encountered pickpockets, kidnappers, rat-infested slums, and wild monkeys. There are no wild monkeys in Rio. I later visited Rio and saw hundreds of wild monkeys there. I also got robbed twice within 4 hours of arriving. The second robbery occurred 40 feet from a cop who was sunning himself on the hood of his police car. He chose not to get involved. Editor's note, did me, yes, yes, yes. The weirdest reaction came after the Simpsons visited Canada. The next day, Canadians complained, "You didn't make enough fun of us, eh? There's a whole lot of dumb stuff up here." Oh, Canada, big country, small ego. I'd been asked to give my Simpsons lecture in 21 foreign countries, from Israel to India, China to Chile, Qatar to, well, something else that starts with a Q. In Qatar, I played to a packed house full of men in long white robes and women in burqas. People from every economic class, from millionaires to billionaires. These guys love The Simpsons and its irreverent wit, but they were shocked to hear it coming from an actual human being. It's that weird paradox. When Homer strangles his son, it's funny. When you do it, it's a felony. At one point I said, I was asked not to show my Queer Duck cartoons today because I was told there are no homosexuals in Qatar. Which is crazy, because I can see 8 from where I'm standing. There was a stunned silence followed by an explosion of laughter, which is the only kind of explosion you want to hear in the Middle East. One cheek leaped from his seat and ran up and down the aisle. He couldn't contain his delight. They'd never seen anything like me. Literally, the only other Jew in Qatar is in the Royal Zoo. Homer Simpson and Mr. Peabody. Every Christmas, the Simpsons producers give the staff a gift. Past examples include a skateboard with Bart's picture on it, a yellow bowling ball with Homer's name on it, and a crystal ice bucket with Moe's face etched in it. Moe's picture actually decreases its collectible value. A lot of thought and a lot of time go into these presents, so much so that the staff Christmas gift sometimes comes in January or July or not at all. Still, these gifts are always appreciated by the writers and the cleaning ladies they re-gift them to. In 2009, we all received a TomTom GPS that spoke in Homer's voice. This was a great gift, especially in those days before Waze and other phone apps. Dan Castellaneta spent 4 days in the studio recording Homerish directions.
Ooh, ooh, right turn ahead. Tunnel.
Every journey ended with, "You have reached your destination and can hold your head up high because you are a genius." It was very entertaining for the first few trips. After a while, those jokes get on your nerves, said Mike Price, and he's the Simpsons guy who wrote those jokes. Still, I stuck with the Homer GPS, unaware I could change the voice setting to blandly soothing English lady. I put Homer to the test on one of our less exotic trips, Salem, Massachusetts. I set the GPS for the Peabody Essex Museum, and it brought me to a scruffy Revolution-era home. When I walked in, the tour guide seemed genuinely shocked to see a customer, saying, "Nobody ever comes here." I told him, "My friend said the Peabody Essex is one of the great art museums of New England." The guide said, "This isn't the Peabody Essex Museum. It's the George Peabody House Museum. You're not even in the right town." I felt like a fool taking my driving directions from the stupidest man in cartoon history. Just then the museum's phone rang, something else that rarely happened around there. The guide listened for a while and then turned to me. "It's the local paper. It's a slow news day and they're looking for a story. Are you anybody?" "Kind of," I said. "I'm a writer for The Simpsons. In fact, I was directed here by a Homer Simpson GPS." "Holy cow, what a story!" he exclaimed, as if I were the Lindbergh baby all grown up and had arrived with my wife, Amelia Earhart. Minutes later, a car screeched up in front of the museum and a reporter raced in. This was the most excitement the George Peabody House Museum had seen since George Peabody died. The reporter breathlessly interviewed my wife and me, took our pictures, and roared away. Shortly after, I got directions, written directions, and a map to the real Peabody Essex Museum. It was as great as promised. The next day, I was walking through downtown Peabody when a passing driver leaned out his window. "Hey, Homer Simpson," he yelled in his northeastern Massachusetts dialect. "You're a pisser." "Who is this guy? How does he know me, and why am I a pissa?" I spotted a newspaper box on the corner. Under a banner headline was the top story in the local paper. "Worst GPS ever, get Simpsons writer to Peabody." There was also a huge color photo of my wife and me. We would not merit a photo this huge if she had ridden me to victory in the Kentucky Derby. It really had been a slow news day. When I got home, I gave the Homer Simpson GPS to my cleaning lady. She doesn't have a car or speak English, but she seemed to enjoy it. The worst man in Australia. Australians love The Simpsons, except naturally, the episode where the family goes there. That episode was condemned in the Australian Parliament, which is a Hooters, by the way. They didn't object to us saying the Australian penal system involved kicking offenders with a giant boot, or that their Prime Minister's office was an inner tube in a pond. Nope. What they didn't like was our cat's attempt at doing an Australian accent. Mind you, the true Australian accent is semi-incomprehensible, and I use that term precisely. You can understand exactly one half of what an Australian person says. Generally, it's the first half. "You know, if I was running your Congress, I'd langa-danga-danga-langa-danga-danga." But sometimes you can only follow the second half. "Langa-danga-langa-danga-danga, and I woke up with a dead hooker covered in shrimp." I've made six wonderful trips down under and have met only one local who didn't love The Simpsons. He was my tour guide in the city of Cairns. What follows is a verbatim transcript from the day we spent together. "So, what do you do for a living, mate?" "I write for a cartoon show called The Simpsons." "Well, that's a bloody stupid show." "Gee, most people here seem to like it." "Oh yeah, my daughter does. I can't tell you how many times I've had to smack her in the mouth for quoting your show." "This is your daughter with leukemia?" "That's the one." "I can't abide the disrespect you people show to religion." "That's funny, because the show was recently praised for its Christian values by Pope Benedict." "Well, he's a stupid wanker, isn't he? Now look over there. That's our new waterfront area. Bleeding horrible. Developed by the Jews. They got no sense of taste whatsoever." "You know, I'm Jewish." The guy tapped his nose and said, "Oh, I could tell, mate." The tour came to an end with me wondering how much you tip an anti-Semitic child beater. And that's when he said, "Here's my address. You think you could send my daughter an autographed script from your show? I'd be happy to. And one for me too?" Four places to die before you see. I've been to more than 100 countries and had a great time in most of them. but here are a few you can skip. Number 1, Ghana. There are 4 long skinny countries in West Africa resembling 4 fingers. 3 of them are very nice: Togo, Benin, and Côte d'Ivoire. The big fat middle finger is Ghana. This is the angriest place I've ever been. I saw a fist fight every day. One time my driver jumped out of the cab and beat up a traffic cop. A big industry in Ghana is novelty coffins, hand-carved to look like pumpkins, pigeons, Porsches, you name it. It's a much better place to be dead than alive. Number 2, Algeria. French colonists left Algeria with 2 gifts, surliness and the baguette. Every morning you see cranky Algerians walking around, noshing on yard-long loaves of French bread. They're cheap. The cost is subsidized by the government, so the locals eat as much as they want and drop the rest on the ground. By noon, the streets are ankle-deep with half baguettes. It's a vaguely surreal sight. No wonder Camus set his novels there. Number 3, Cuba. Next time you see an article on colorful, vibrant Cuba, look at the pictures. You can't get a decent photo of Havana because it's a crumbling, filthy city where nothing's been fixed since Meyer Lansky left. Castro did the impossible and turned a tropical paradise into a little slice of Cold War Hungary. Number 4, Honduras, the Springfield of Nations. Visit a city known as the most dangerous non-war zone on Earth, and even worse, the birthplace of comedian Carlos Mencia. The national cuisine is Pizza Hut and Applebee's, and the service leaves something to be desired. Here's a verbatim exchange. Waiter, tonight our choices are chicken and fish. Thanks, we'd like one of each. And will you be joining us for dinner? Yes, I'll have the chicken, my wife will have the fish. Yes, and for the lady, she will have the fish. Very good, 2 fish. Me, fine, 2 fish. He brought our dinner 2 hours later, 3 beef burritos. In another restaurant, for reasons I never understood, I was literally chased out by an old lady with a butcher's knife. So much went wrong on my trip to Honduras that I often forget to mention I was kidnapped there. My tour driver threatened to dump me in the jungle unless I paid him $100. When I refused, he lowered his demand to 100 quetzals, which is $12. I still said no. Ultimately, the driver dumped us at our destination without stopping for a prepaid lunch. Yes, I was 53 years old, and a bully stole my lunch money. Burning question. Why has the show lasted so long? As I mentioned at the start of the book, before The Simpsons debuted, no one thought it would last more than 6 weeks. Back then, an offbeat show, even a great one like Police Squad, lasted an average of 6 weeks. It's now been more than 1,500 weeks, going on 30 years, and The Simpsons is still in business. 30 years! Let this sink in. If The Simpsons had been aging like real people, Bart would be 40, Marge would be collecting Social Security, and Homer would have been dead for 8 years. What is the secret of the show's longevity? Critics and scholars have proposed theories that range from the wrong to the really, really, really wrong. No one's had a good explanation, and I finally realized we're all asking the wrong question. The question is, why don't other shows last as long as The Simpsons? The answer is actors. Actors in live-action shows get bored doing the same role week after week. Jerry Seinfeld got tired of playing Jerry Seinfeld. The friends on Friends stopped being friends. Only one live-action show has lasted nearly as long as The Simpsons, and that's because it had a star who never complained. The show was called Lassie. But animation goes on forever. Family Guy remains a hit after 15 years, South Park is in its 22nd season, and Mickey Mouse is still around after 90 years of creepy unfunniness. Which raises the question, when will it end? My response is always the same. Stop asking. It's rude. It's like saying, Grandma, when are you going to die? She doesn't know and she doesn't want to think about it. Even our producers grapple with this question. Every 5 years they'll say, well, it's been 20, 25, 30 seasons. Maybe we should wrap it up. This is like going to the same grandma and saying, Nana, you're 75. That's a good round number. Drop dead. None of the writers want the show to end, not as long as we have stories to tell and ex-wives to support. Furthermore, no one is quite sure how to end the series. We've been pondering this for decades and nobody's had a good idea. Before the show ever came on the air, before we had any idea what it would become, Matt Groening had two ideas for a final episode. Number one, reveal that Krusty is really Homer. If you look at a design of Krusty without makeup, you'll see he looks just like Homer. Even though Bart loves Krusty and hates Homer, they're really the same guy. Number two, have Marge remove her tall bouffant hairdo to reveal long bunny ears beneath, like the long-eared rabbits in Matt Groening's Life in Hell comic strip. How's that for a series finale? Homer is Krusty, and Marge is a giant rabbit. It's a wrap-up as irritating as the final Seinfeld and as baffling as the last Lost. In 2011, the end of The Simpsons seemed a very real possibility. Our ratings were still high, but our budget was out of control. After two decades of incremental raises, even our janitor was pulling down $700,000 a year. Just when it looked like we needed a final episode, we got one. Stuart Burns wrote Holidays of Future Past. The show came back from Korean animation, and it was sweet, funny, and clever. A holiday show set 30 years from now, it revealed what the future held for all our characters. We had the perfect end of the series. The Simpsons began with a Christmas show, now it would end with one. Problem solved. Then we got horrible news. We weren't canceled. Everyone at The Simpsons, the actors, the writers, even that janitor, took a pay cut. Why? Because we love our jobs and we love our show. Holidays of Future Past aired 7 years ago, so we still have no final show. Maybe we'll just use our last episode to tie up loose ends. Maggie will finally talk. Grandpa will drop dead. Mr. Burns will drop dead. Homer will shoot Flanders. Marge will shoot Homer. Then she'll take off her hair and reveal she's a rabbit. Act 3! In a Simpsons script, Act 3 is where we must wrap up the story, at which point we realize we don't have an ending. We try a lot of goofy stuff that gets rewritten more than any other part. In the end, running out of time and patience, we usually go with the last idea pitched, not the best one. Act 3 of this book is sort of like that. My life after leaving The Simpsons, creating a memorable series, The Critic, an unmemorable series, Teen Angel, as well as children's books, animated films, and plays, all before realizing I was an idiot and running back to The Simpsons. Chapter 11. On Comedy. Because this is a book about comedy, and because I'm being paid by the word, I thought I'd spend some time talking about comedy in general. Not that comedy can be taught. I've never taken a comedy writing class, nor have I worked with a comedy writer who has. Humor isn't something you study or analyze. It's just something you pick up. As a kid, you watch the shows that make you laugh, and you begin to discriminate between the funny, Bugs Bunny, and the not funny, Woody Woodpecker. When I was 6 years old and watched Woody Allen do stand-up on the Ed Sullivan Show, I thought, this guy really gets me. Comedy became my savior. As a kid, if you're bad at sports and not good-looking, you start trying to be funny yourself. You begin by repeating the great jokes you heard. Then you try doing your own jokes in their style. Finally, you do your own material. If no one laughs, you quit comedy and become a bitter alcoholic. But if they do laugh, if they do, you go into comedy and become a bitter alcoholic. It's exactly the same way a baby learns to talk. The baby is just listening, trying to figure out what the hell is going on. Eventually, the baby will babble a few sounds, and this will get amazing feedback from the parents. So the baby will learn a word, then a few more, and pretty soon the kid will be talking so much, you wish he'd just shut the F up. But no baby ever learns to talk from taking a class. You never meet a baby who says, "I'm studying talking with this professional talker down at the learning annex. Last week he taught us Baba." I was born 3 weeks early. My mom had gone to see the Jacques Tati comedy, Mr. Hulot's Holiday, and she laughed so hard she went into labor. I always thought this was an exciting origin story.
"I am comedy man, born from the power of laughter."
But 20 years later, I actually saw Mr. Hulot's Holiday, and I couldn't figure out what my mom was laughing at. It's not that the jokes were bad, it's that they were non-existent. Jacques Tati was a comedian only the French could love. So why am I funny? If you're thinking, he's not funny, well, screw you. I don't think I have a talent or a gift. I write comedy because I can't help myself. Exhibit A. I've traveled the world from Algeria to Zanzibar, and I've only gotten food poisoning once. It was from a health food restaurant in Beverly Hills. I lay in bed sweating and shivering for 3 days before I dragged myself to the emergency room. When the doctor asked me my symptoms, I told him in a string of jokes because this is how I talk. I said, "Doc, my tongue is the color of Whoopi Goldberg, and I'm actually throwing up food other people ate, and stuff is oozing out of both ends of me. I'm like a human cannoli." The doctor laughed and called the nurses in. "Do it for them." So I did a second show for the nurses. I was dying, but I was killing. The doctor patted me on the back. "Mr. Reese, if you can make all these jokes, clearly you're not that sick." He sent me on my way. An hour later, they found me collapsed in the hospital parking lot. Exhibit B. My wife and I went to Hawaii on our honeymoon, and we visited Pearl Harbor. This is a convenient symbol for how the whole honeymoon went. We were standing over the wreck of the battleship Missouri, one of the most solemn spots in America, and I started laughing. Here's why. I looked over and saw a group of tourists from Tokyo smiling and chatting away in Japanese. I imagine they were saying, "Nice work, boys. Look at the hole in that boat. This is a day that will live in famy." Being funny is like being tall. People always ask me, "Are there days when you wake up and you're not funny?" Nobody asks Kobe Bryant, "Are there days when you wake up and you're not tall?" Like Kobe Bryant, I'm just lucky there's a job that pays me to be this way. A century ago, someone like Kobe would work in a store. He'd be the guy you ask to get stuff off a high shelf. Similarly, a guy like me would be locked in the basement of a madhouse, wrapped in cold, wet sheets. But I'm not a madman, a genius, or an artist. I'm actually more like a chicken. Sometimes things form in my brain and they get bigger and bigger until I just have to write them down to free up some space in my head. It's the same way a chicken lays an egg. And when people eat that egg, the chicken's probably thinking, "Really? You like that? It just came out of my butt." I'm just lucky I can do this for a living because I have no other skills. I can't sing or dance or play a musical instrument. I can't skate or ski or speak a foreign language. I type this whole book with one finger. So what would I do if I couldn't write comedy? I'd write for Jimmy Fallon. I mean, look at it. Fallon is just kind of "no laugh" spelled backwards. The fact is, if I couldn't write comedy, I'd probably be a funny lawyer, the kind who gets a lot of laughs in court, and then his client goes to the electric chair for shoplifting. I told that joke in Qatar, and a Saudi Arabian in the audience went, "Yeah, so?" There were three great comedians in my formative years, Bill Cosby, Bill Murray, and Richard Pryor, and they wrecked comedy for a generation. How? By never saying anything funny. You can quote a Steve Martin joke or a Rodney Dangerfield line, but Pryor, Cosby, and Murray, the things they said were funny only when they said them. In Cosby's case, it didn't even need to be sentences. He'd say stuff like, "The thing of the thing puts the milk in the toast," and ha ha ha. It was gibberish and America loved it. The problem was that they inspired a generation of comedians who tried coasting on personality. They were all attitude and no jokes. It was also a time when comedy stars didn't seem to care. Bill Murray made some lousy movies. Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy made even more. And any script that was too lame for these guys, Chevy Chase made. These were smart people. They had to know how bad these films were, but they just grabbed a paycheck and did them. Most of these comic actors started as writers. They could have written their own scripts, but they rarely bothered. Then, at the end of a decade of lazy comedy and half-baked material, The Simpsons came along. We cared about jokes, and we worked endless hours to cram as many into a show as possible. I'm not sure we can take all the credit, but TV and movies started trying harder. Jokes were back. Shows like 30 Rock and Arrested Development demanded that you pay attention. These days, comedy stars like Seth Rogen, Amy Schumer, Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, and Jonah Hill actually write the comedies they star in. So what is comedy? I've spent my whole life making it, and yet I have no idea. I've read all the philosophers on humor, Aristotle, Freud, Henri Bergson, and they're completely clueless. The latest theory, according to a fascinating book called The Humor Code, calls comedy an act of benign transgression. For example, why did the chicken cross the road? It was an act of benign transgression. I think all these theories are nonsense. Comedy is too weird and wonderful and subjective to have an overarching theory. I mean, what unites Nichols and May with Cheech and Chong? Nothing, except that they both suck. I do have a theory of jokes, however. It's not comprehensive or profound, but it's an observation I've never heard anyone else make. When a joke is over, it's over. All the loose ends are tied up, the journey is complete. All the weirdness that preceded the punchline now makes sense. Here's an example. A duck walks into a pharmacy and asks for chapstick. The druggist says, "Will that be cash or credit?" And the duck says, "You can put it on my bill." Think of all the questions this story raises. Why is a duck in a pharmacy? Why does he need chapstick? He has no lips. He can talk too. But none of this surprises the druggist. He's just worried about how he's going to get paid. But with that punchline, "You can put it on my bill," all those questions collapse. In a crazy twist of logic, it all starts to make sense. We have no further questions, and we don't care whether the duck gets over his case of chap bill. The hell with him. I love the illogical logic of some jokes. Take this line by George Carlin. "Beethoven was so deaf, he thought he was a painter." It kind of makes sense. By the way, I consider Carlin the greatest comedian ever. He delivered his jokes so beautifully, and they're funny even when I steal them. A joke doesn't have to be illogical either. Sometimes a punchline wraps it up like a tidy mystery story. Let me close by telling you one of my favorites. A bartender is closing up shop, and he sees a patron lying on the floor. He picks him up, the guy falls down. He picks him up, the guy falls down. Finally, the bartender slings the guy over his shoulder and carries him to an address he found in the guy's wallet. When they get to the guy's house, the bartender stands him up again, and he crumples into a heap. The bartender bangs on the door, and the guy's wife answers. "Here's your drunken bum of a husband," the bartender says. The wife asks, "Where's his wheelchair?" Great comedies you've never seen, but should. The American Film Institute made a list of the 100 greatest comedies of all time, called AFI, 100 Years, 100 Laughs. That works out to one laugh per year, or roughly what Dane Cook has given me. The AFI list is very solid, with lots of movies you really should see. Annie Hall, Animal House, Airplane, Groundhog Day, all the usual suspects. I don't really care for their top two picks. Tootsie, A Man in a Dress, and Some Like It Hot, Two Men in Dresses. Although I do like number 67, Mrs. Doubtfire, A Man in an Old Lady Dress. Nazis don't seem funny, but they score three films on the list. The Hitler Hat Trick. They've got The Producers, To Be or Not to Be, and The Great Dictator. But where are the funny zombies? There's a surprising number of great zombie comedies, and none of them made the list. Zombieland, Shaun of the Dead, Dead Alive, Evil Dead 2, Army of Darkness, and the deeply satirical Dawn of the Dead, where zombies stumble around a mall like brain-dead consumers. You should see every one of Tex Avery's hilarious cartoons, as well as the live-action cartoons they inspired, The Mask, Kung Fu Hustle, and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. The Marx Brothers have four films on the AFI list, but they made a couple of later films that are very underrated, Go West and A Night in Casablanca. And any comedy fan has to see the documentary The Aristocrats. In it, 75 different comedians tell the exact same joke. And it's not even a very good joke. But they all tell it in different styles, and it demonstrates how many different ways there are to be funny. It's also the Olympics of comedy, as you judge which comic tells the joke the best. I agree with the filmmaker's choice, Gilbert Gottfried. Finally, here's a list of great comedies you've never seen and probably never heard of. Number one is 1-2-3, 1961. Billy Wilder mixes the Cold War with the Cola Wars in this film about a Coke executive in West Berlin. The movie revs up to a breakneck comic clip for its whole second hour. The pace was so grueling, star Jimmy Cagney quit acting for the next 20 years. Number two, Top Secret, 1984. The makers of Airplane followed that hit with this fizzle. The movie's not ha-ha funny, but it's definitely weird funny, filled with great surreal jokes, like the Nazi falling off a tower and shattering like glass on the ground. If you were disappointed in its original release, give it another look. Number three, Hot Fuzz, 2007. Simon Pegg writes great films for himself, and his small-town cop movie has one of the best-constructed screenplays ever. There's not one line in the film's first half that doesn't pay off in the second. Number four, The High Sign, 1921. The first film directed by Buster Keaton and the only movie I've ever considered to be too funny. It's so stuffed with inspired comedy, I wish it had been spread out over two or three films. Number five, The Man with Two Brains, 1983. One of Steve Martin's funniest films and one of his biggest duds. It's just pure jokes, most of them great. Number six, Ni Vu Ni Connu, 1958. This French tale of a poacher and a cop is the funniest film you've never ever heard of. I stumbled on it at the Museum of Modern Art. I have no idea where you can see it. I don't even know what the title means. The six greatest books about comedy, besides the one you're listening to. Number one, Born Standing Up, A Comic's Life. Steve Martin takes you through the many years it took him to develop his comedy persona. It's a very serious book about being funny. Number two, Wake Me When It's Funny. Gary Marshall has dozens of hilarious stories about breaking into TV comedy and eventually conquering the medium. Number three, Even This I Get to Experience. Norman Lear doing the same thing as Gary Marshall. These first three are even better as audiobooks, read with comic panache by their authors. Don't you just love audiobooks? Number four, Sick in the Head, Conversations About Life and Comedy. Judd Apatow interviews pretty much every comedian alive, in the quickest 576 pages you'll ever breeze through. Number 5, American Cornball, A Laugh-O-Pedic Guide to the Formerly Funny. The only scholarly analysis on humor that gets it right. Author Christopher Miller catalogs hundreds of great comic cliches that have faded into the past, like absent-minded professors, naked guys wearing barrels, and safes falling on people's heads. He explains that the Simpsons family therapy scene where they electrocute each other is just, quotes, a pie fight with electricity. I wrote that scene and never realized it, but he's right. Number 6, Poking a Dead Frog, Conversations with Today's Top Comedy Writers. Don't pay for a comedy writing class. Everything you need to know is in this book by Mike Sachs. Comedy writers in every field of entertainment describe how they create humor and offer solid practical advice on getting a job. Tweets for the Sweet. I love everything about the above-mentioned Poking a Dead Frog except the title. What the hell does that mean? The book even taught me something new, that late-night comedy shows are recruiting writers from Twitter. It's a great showcase for young writers. The Simpsons' new staff member, Megan Amram, got her start on Twitter, amassing 700,000 followers. It's also a great training tool for aspiring writers. The 280-character limit enforces brevity, a comic necessity, and the number of likes and retweets provides instant feedback on how funny the joke is. And so at the age of 57, I started tweeting, and even after 35 years as a professional, it's making me a better comedy writer. Follow me at Mike Reese Writer. Here's a sampling of tweets. OJ leaves prison, saying, I just want to be left alone so I can shiv a former wife. Whoops, I mean live a normal life. Chevy Chase turned 74 today. Thanks for all the year of laughter and all the great movie. To those who say name is destiny, I counter with Pete Best, Donnie Most, and Cedric the Entertainer. News story, man burns at Burning Man. His last words were, the irony stings, but what really hurts is the burning. Trump doesn't act like a president. He acts like Gary Busey playing a president. Jimi Hendrix would be 75 this month. If he'd lived, he'd be dead by now. If you're looking for good news in these turbulent times, think of this. Julia Roberts hardly ever makes movies anymore. Unlike Coldplay songs, no two snowflakes are exactly the same. After a long battle with depression, Charlie Brown has killed himself. Friends, family overcome with good grief. Wouldn't it be cool if George Romero died and came back as a zombie? Or George Lucas died and came back as a robot? Or Michael Bay died? Headline. Madman lures 5 children to abandoned building. 4 die. That's a synopsis of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Chapter 12. How Krusty Became the Critic. As Al and I were completing our 2 years running The Simpsons, Matt Groening came to us with a new idea, an animated Krusty the Clown spinoff. We developed the concept, imagining Krusty as a single dad in New York with a crabby makeup lady and a crazy Ted Turner-like boss. Matt turned us down, deciding he'd rather do a live-action Krusty reality show in which Dan Castellaneta, who voices the character, would go around having adventures like working on a tuna boat or delivering a baby. That makes 2 shows that didn't happen. A year later, in 1993, Jim Brooks told us he wanted to do a sitcom set at a morning program like The Today Show. Al and I kicked it around and decided to focus on the show's Gene Shalit-like movie critic. We fleshed it out with all the rejected Krusty show ideas. Single dad in New York, crabby makeup lady, Ted Turner boss. Comedy, like composting, involves smart recycling. Jim liked the idea and asked if we were fans of John Lovitz. He'd just seen him in Penny Marshall's movie, A League of Their Own. We loved Lovitz and had had him on The Simpsons 3 times. Al and I were more than happy to develop a live-action critic pilot for Lovitz. But we neglected to tell Lovitz. When we finally presented a finished script to him, he said, "I can't do a TV show. I'm a movie star." In all fairness, he did have 3 movies lined up. City Slickers 2, Trapped in Paradise, and Rob Reiner's movie North. Lovitz would later say, "3 movies, 3 bombs. Lovitz was about to walk out of our meeting when Al and I said in desperation, "What if it's animated?" And just like that, he was in, and The Critic was born. It became the only animated show in history where the very last creative decision was to make it a cartoon. Based on the success of The Simpsons, Jim Brooks got a great deal with ABC. No matter what idea he came in with, they had to make 22 episodes of it. They couldn't say no. Excitedly, we went with Jim to ABC with The Pitch, an animated show about a film critic starring John Lovitz. "No," they said. After some negotiation, they finally agreed to make 13 episodes. This was the start of The Critic's rocky road on TV. You gotta love it. I first saw John Lovitz when I was working at The Tonight Show. LA's improv troupe, The Groundlings, were guests, and a very young Lovitz performed his character, Tommy Flanagan, the pathological liar. Even then, I saw he was special. I met John years later at a Simpsons table reading, where he was guest starring as Marge's prom date, Artie Ziff. Before we began, I mentioned a story from the newspaper. It says thieves are cutting off people's hands in downtown L.A. to get their Rolexes. "You mean like this one?" said John, shoving his fat Rolex in my face. He is the master of upbeat bluster and unearned self-confidence. But is that the real John Lovitz? It's an interesting philosophical point. It's not who John is. It's merely a character he plays 24 hours a day. In unguarded moments, John can be shy and self-critical. He's always apologizing to me for no good reason. John Lovitz apologizes for no good reason. Quote, "I would get all frustrated, and sometimes I give Mike and Al a hard time. I felt bad about that, because they couldn't have been nicer. I actually apologized to Mike about giving him a hard time, and he said, 'I don't have any memory of that. I just always remember your being very nice and very pleasant.' How good, because sometimes I do get a little cranky." John Lovitz also plays classical piano, speaks fluent French, and sings opera. His stage debut was in, picture this, Death of a Salesman. On The Critic, we surrounded him with a truly eclectic cast, ranging from the voice of Babe, the sheep-herding pig, Christine Cavanaugh, to softcore porn actor, Charles Napier. We had the world's greatest impressionist, Maurice LaMarche, and the man of 1,000 accents, Nick Jameson. Between them, they do 60 characters per episode, and we paid by the character. Everyone's favorite actor on the show wasn't an actor at all. The role of makeup woman Doris was played by Doris Grau, the Simpsons script supervisor. The hardest part to cast was Margot, critic Jay Sherman's sympathetic sister. We hired and fired 4 different actresses, including Margaret Cho, before realizing the perfect Margot was right in front of us, Nancy Cartwright. "For me," Nancy said, "it was fantastic because I wasn't Bart, Nelson, Ralph, Kearney, Database, Todd Flanders. I was actually going to get to play a girl. I had some ideas at first, but then they just said they wanted me to do it as me." Designing these characters was a lot harder. We didn't have a visionary artist like Matt Groening, so we put together an amazing team. David Silverman from The Simpsons, Rich Moore from Wreck-It Ralph, Everett Peck, who did Duckman, and David Cutler, who worked on The Nightmare Before Christmas. I'm afraid we designed it by committee, with us non-artistic producers mixing and matching different parts of different characters. It was a Frankenstein process, and some people said J. Sherman even looked like Frankenstein with his flat square head. Once the show debuted, we learned that J. was coincidentally a dead ringer for real-life film critic James Wolcott. Al and I gave J. Sherman two memorable catchphrases. It stinks, which needs no explanation, and hachi-machi, which needs lots. I heard hachi-machi just once as a kid, and I never forgot it. It was a cry of dismay uttered by a member of Hermine's Royal Lilliputians, a troupe of performing little people. We hired a crackerjack writing team, about half of them Harvard film nerds. In fact, the critic's Slavic restaurateur, Vlada, was named after our film professor, Vlada Petrik. The character design of Vlada is based on Hungarian Simpsons animator Gabor Csupo. It was a boys' club, about a dozen men working on the whole production. But in our defense, two of these 12 men have since become women. Top that, Transparent. We also had a consulting writer on the show, a funny kid who'd come in one or two days a week. His name was Judd Apatow. Judd Apatow on Working at the Critic. Quote, Mike and Al had an enormous amount of energy and patience. They did something I've never seen anybody do since. They didn't get up all day long. We would go in and it would be like 10 in the morning until sometimes between 8 and 10 at night. And Mike and Al wouldn't stand up all day. They would just sit in their chairs. Al would have a cup filled with M&Ms and peanuts and pretzels and whatever he was grazing on. And they would just pitch jokes for 10 to 12 straight hours. They almost never even left the room to listen to sound mixes or have meetings. Now that I've run shows, I've always wondered, when did they have meetings? I don't remember Mike and Al leaving the room. They just had such patience and loved being in the room. A Tale of Two Critics. The Critic debut did great ratings and rave reviews. 2 days later, my assistant D walked in with a large cardboard box bulging at the seams. What's that? I asked. She replied, it's hate mail. The sensibility that had served us so well on The Simpsons was too raw and edgy for ABC's family-friendly audience. Viewers were particularly incensed by a scene where Jay sleeps with an actress on their first date. I'm glad we cut the line where the critic says, even my orgasms feel better. Ironically, throughout our run, we were the top-rated show on TV among children, even bigger than The Simpsons. The ratings eroded fast, and ABC pulled us off the air after 6 weeks. 6 weeks, there it is. Despite this annoyance, they'd been very supportive throughout the entire process. At a meeting with network president Bob Iger, he gestured to a wall-sized chart of ABC's programs and asked, where on the schedule do you see your show fitting in? I muttered, Sunday night on Fox after The Simpsons. And that's just where we went. Jim Brooks managed to move The Critic from ABC to Fox. It was a huge deal requiring the cooperation of French and German production companies. It was the first time these two countries had collaborated since the Vichy government. It turned out to be just as successful. Fox slated us to go on after The Simpsons. They tried 8 different series in that slot, and nothing had worked. To launch the series, Jim Brooks decided we'd do a crossover episode on The Simpsons, where the critic judges the Springfield Film Festival. Crossovers are a television tradition. The Beverly Hillbillies visited Petticoat Junction, The Love Boat went to Fantasy Island, The Jetsons crossed time to meet the Flintstones. Jim Brooks did them all the time, mixing characters from his 3 sitcoms, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Rhoda, and Phyllis. As a kid, I used to love crossovers. They showed me that all these characters on different shows lived in the same universe and they were all friends. When it came time to do the episode, there was a huge outcry from the Simpsons staff. Showrunner David Merkin was on board with it, but the rest of the staff said, we will not allow this. What was especially hurtful was that our most vocal opponents were also our friends. People Al and I had hired onto The Simpsons were fighting against us. but the loudest mouth in the room belonged to a writer who had just been hired at the show. He'd been there only a few weeks, but decided he knew best what was appropriate for The Simpsons. He didn't last long at the show. We went to Jim Brooks to report on the insurrection, and he uttered one of my favorite lines in a lifetime of great lines. When did this become a democracy? We proceeded to do the episode, entirely written and produced by the critics' staff. The Simpsons writers had put up so much resistance that we worked extra hard to make it a great show. It has since become a fan favorite, generating at least one classic Simpsons line. While everyone at the film festival is booing Mr. Burns, he asks Smithers, "Are they saying boo?" Smithers replies, "No, they're saying Boo Earns. Boo Earns." When the show finally aired, all the Simpsons writers who'd opposed the idea were contractually still able to get producing credit on the episode if they wanted it. Indeed, they wanted it. They all took a paycheck for it, too. Every one of them took credit and pay for a show where their only contribution was trying to keep it from happening. Well, not everyone. The one person who didn't take credit was Matt Groening, who discreetly took his name off the show. I don't think we noticed it first, and I believe it's the only time on any Simpsons episode that Matt's name doesn't appear in the credits. This led someone in post-production to leak the fact to the Los Angeles Times, which ran with the story. Matt said he did it because it, quote, violates the Simpsons universe, adding, "Through all the years of The Simpsons, we have been careful about maintaining their uniqueness." Jim Brooks came to our defense, saying Matt was ungrateful for all the work we had done on the show. Quote, "For years, Al and Mike were two guys who worked their hearts out on this show, staying up until 4 in the morning to get it right. The critic is their shot, and he should be giving them his support." This was Antietam at The Simpsons, the bloodiest conflict of our Civil War, and in hindsight, it wasn't that big a deal. Still, there was so much bitterness over it that years later, when we were doing DVD commentary on the episode, all that resentment came pouring out. It was so bilious that Jim said, "This is terrible, we can't use this." So, for the only time in our history, we erased the track and did a second commentary. Jim gets mad on that one, too. Matt Groening and I have laughed about it since. The Simpsons would go on to do crossovers with Family Guy, The X-Files, and Futurama. Matt had no problem with that last one. He Who Must Not Be Named. The president of Fox, who bought The Critic to put on after The Simpsons, got fired before the show actually aired. The new president, who came in, just hated the show. The Critic got stellar ratings in its debut on Fox. He called not to congratulate us, but to say, "How well do you think it will do without any publicity? Huh?" We had just given him a successful show, and here he was refusing to publicize it. We were all baffled. Lovitz recalls, "I called Jim Brooks to see why it was happening, and he said, 'I've never seen anything like this.'" We aired 10 episodes on Fox, and the network president phoned after 8 of them to say how much he hated the show. Once he called us in for a meeting, he played an episode on his monitor to demonstrate how bad our show was. When his staff started laughing, he snapped at them, "Why are you laughing? This isn't funny." After 6 weeks, he canceled the show and replaced it with a series he had developed called House of Buggin'. Maybe that was the problem with The Critic. Not enough buggin'. The final irony was that this guy quit as Fox president a few months later. He came, canceled our show, and left without a trace. It was like he was a demon from hell, summoned up solely to cancel The Critic before descending back into the fiery cauldron where he belongs. There's a rule in show business that you never badmouth anyone by name, because somewhere down the road you may want to work with them again. That's usually a good rule. But this Fox president was named John Matoyan. John Matoyan, John Matoyan, John Matoyan, John Matoyan, John Matoyan. The next year we had an offer to revive The Critic at UPN, a new network that had just started up. But they wanted to dumb down our content and shift the focus from Jay Sherman to his son Marty and his childhood friends. I said no, that wasn't the show. Plus, I couldn't bear the possibility of being canceled on three networks in 3 years. The critic was not dead yet. During the 2000 dot-com boom, Al and I were asked to make original critic shorts for the internet. We'd be using flash animation, meaning we could produce a cartoon in 9 days instead of 9 months. We'd be able to parody movies while they were still in theaters. Al and I reunited the old cast and wrote and produced 10 short cartoons. Then, for reasons I'll never understand, the production company sat on the shorts for 10 months. It actually took longer to get the shorts on the net than to do fully animated episodes for the networks. That production company went bust, and The Critic was finally finished. It was fun making the show, and I loved working with Lovitz. But in 2 years with the guy, he never learned my name. He always referred to Al Jean and me as Al and Jean. That's one thing he could apologize for. More than two decades later, people still tell me how much they love the series. It's hard to believe about a show full of parodies of now obscure 90s movies. It's a little dated. In fact, every single episode opens with a shot of the World Trade Center. You can still see The Critic on the Crackle and Reels networks, and crisp copies of every episode are posted on YouTube. We're still considering partnering with the Jehovah's Witnesses to go door to door with the show, because it's our belief that there's no medium so small The Critic can't fail in it. I'll give the last word to John Lovitz, the guy who didn't want to do the show in the first place, because he's a movie star. John says, if you go on my Twitter feed, every week you can see people asking about it. And I'd love to do it again. I've tried. But Al's doing The Simpsons, and Mike said go ahead, but he doesn't want to do it himself. I'd do a Kickstarter. I'd do this or that. I even said, why don't we do it as a live sitcom? But it's just sitting there. And meanwhile, millions of fans want it back. Al Jean on The Critic. I think the last thing Mike and I argued about was a thing on The Critic. We were doing a parody of Orson Welles doing a commercial about peas. I think I wanted to extend it into the black or something, and he didn't. That would have been 22 years ago, the last creative difference we had. Author's note. Al wanted Orson Welles to say, after exiting screen, oh, what luck! There's a French fry stuck in my beard. Followed by eating noises. It seemed like overkill. I hated the joke, and every single other person on planet Earth loved it. Loved it! Someone recently posted the clip on Twitter, calling it one of the greatest jokes in TV history. I guess Al was right. Burning question. What's the biggest reason The Critic failed? Al and I were the first Simpsons alumni to create our own animated series. We didn't want to encroach on their territory, so we decided to make The Critic as different from The Simpsons as possible. They were suburban, we were urban. They featured a married couple, we had a divorced dad. They were middle class, we were wealthy. Homer was dumb, Jay Sherman was too smart for his own good. All this deliberate distancing resulted in another difference. They were a hit, we were a dud. Nowadays television is more experimental, audiences more fractured, and people more in need of novelty. But back in the 90s, the way you created a hit show was to take an existing hit and change one thing about it. Seinfeld's a hit? Give him a wife, you've got Mad About You. Throw in some kids, it's Everybody Loves Raymond. Make it suck, and it's Home Improvement. But there's an even more fundamental reason The Critic failed, and it's so obvious no one's ever noticed. Every animated series that succeeded on the big four networks has been about a family. Every single one. The Flintstones, The Jetsons, The Simpsons, King of the Hill, Family Guy, American Dad, Bob's Burgers. That doesn't just hold for animation either. For decades, TV's top-rated sitcom was about a family.